Dr. John White is the Chief Medical Officer of WebMD. He's also worked at director level at the FDA and was also Chief Medical Expert at the Discovery Channel. John runs a course called Improving Executive Decision Making by Thinking Like a Doctor. And I ask about the different frameworks executives can pick up from doctors and use in non-healthcare settings, such as Bayesian logic and assessing what is a symptom versus a cause. John's also a veteran of the health communication space, and we discuss where the future of health content is going.
Can I run by an anxiety that I sometimes have as someone in this communication space? So physician by background, now doing podcasting and such. And
I feel like we're going to do a telehealth visit.
Just don't send me an invoice.
Send you the copay. Send you a copay.
No.
All right, let's go.
I can't afford it.
Let's go.
One of the things I think about is that if I go full-fledged into this, it's kind of cool. I make some cool content and it's fun. But at the end of the day, what am I really doing? You know what I mean? It's like sometimes on the worst days, you might just be like, this is a load of BS. Like I could, you know, there's people out there saving lives, doing cool interventions, and I'm making a podcast that people, maybe it improves that, maybe it makes them smile sometimes, but it's not changing the world. And I just wanted to ask, did you ever have that feeling, or what is your kind of response to that anxiety?
Yeah. And I think part of it is because it's even what in other areas the algorithms promote. You're very focused on what other people are doing, right? In comparison to what you're doing. And in many ways, you know, as we address anxiety in general, it's about learning to control what you can control and not what other people are doing. We can't control other people. So it's part of the focus. I'm not as focused on what other people are doing at this point in my career. And I'm very focused on what I can do to improve people's lives. So even when I see patients, I'm trying to provide them the best care consistent with guidelines. I'm not necessarily thinking anymore, oh, I wonder how other doctors would manage it or treat it. And, you know, I'm not so concerned about what other platforms are doing because I'm trying to make our platform the best platform out there in terms of getting quality information that's going to give you better health. And I have great satisfaction from knowing that we do that day in and day out.
Fair enough. I wanted to move on a little bit to this really interesting course you've got called Improving Executive Decision Making by Thinking Like a Doctor. And the first kind of first principles question I want to ask is that why is it useful for an executive in a non-related field to be thinking like a doctor? Because a lot of doctors I meet, although academically usually quite good, then I don't think they're that smart. Some of them are idiots. So why is it useful to do that?
And thank you for mentioning it's this course on LinkedIn about thinking like a doctor, especially when you're not a doctor, to improve your executive decision making. And, you know, actually LinkedIn approached me because they have a course, Think Like a Lawyer. And they're like, we really want to do this course, Think Like a Doctor. But when you think about it, doctors have to manage multiple tasks at a time. You often have to respond with limited information to make a decision. Asking other people for advice is a key component of being a doctor. We get consults all the time. And it's really this concept that executives can learn from them. And even if we take the example of asking for advice, you know, in some areas of the corporate world, if you ask for advice, it's almost viewed as a weakness. Like, what? Don't you know enough? Why can't you do your job? Why do you have to ask other people for help? You were hired to do this. But in medicine, on the days that I see patients, I'm consulting cardiology, I'm consulting orthopedics, I'm consulting derm. No one looks down on me to say, how come you didn't know what that rash was? Rather, we're all focused on providing the best care to that patient. And they'll say things like, thanks for the consult. And that's a mind shift change. And that's examples like that is what I was trying to get people to think in this course. You can be a better executive in your decision-making if you think like a doctor. And not like all the doctor shows that are out there, that everything is drama, you know, every minute. But there's a lot non-doctors can learn from doctors in terms of how they think. Not always, as you kind of pointed out, but in many ways you can.
Do you think there's ever a hubris with doctors? Because I'm really interested in this element of how domain expertise in one area can give you the impression, kind of like a halo effect, that you'll be very good in different areas as well. And I guess the question I'm pointing to is, in either experientially or from evidence, have you seen that doctors or other kind of highly academic people perform better in these types of roles? Or is it just a case by case thing?
Yeah. You know, I don't know for sure. And you mentioned about hubris. You know, historically, there's been an elitism, right, in terms of the medical profession. I've gone through so many years of school. It's very hierarchical. The doctor, the surgeon's in charge, is the decision maker, and everyone else is supposed to just go along. I think we've made a lot of changes in that over the last 5-10 years, especially, where it's really about a care team. The doctor's not always in charge of everything. The doctor's not necessarily the best person. We have increased specializations. I think part of the challenge is we have an explosion of medical knowledge, and one person can't manage everything. So in some ways, we're democratizing information too by making it more readily available, but then also helping people become experts in smaller areas so they can provide the best care in that space. So it's not a direct answer to your question, but an example is I had some eye issue one day, and I called up an ophthalmologist friend of mine, you know, to ask her a question. And she says to me, "John, I'm retina. You need cornea." I'm like, "What? You're an eye doctor. Like, you still don't remember?" She's like, "No, seriously, you really should call a cornea specialist." And I do think there are some problems with that. So to your question, in some ways, I don't know if they're better, because people become very tunnel vision and just knowing their area. But what I think is interesting about a lot of doctors, not all, and it's true for some other professions as well, there's also a curiosity, right? We want to learn the reason why someone has a certain condition. We want to learn the pathophysiology. There's kind of a natural intellectual curiosity by a lot of people that go into the medical and health profession.
Can you go over maybe 2 or 3 of the most useful frameworks or patterns of thinking or ways of approaching problems that executives either in health or outside of health can learn from doctors? Like, if you had to distill down 2 or 3 of the big lessons, what would they be?
And, you know, I mentioned the point about asking others for advice, but I think it's also about learning how to act, make a decision with limited data, right? So when a patient comes into the emergency room or a patient comes in to the doctor's office, you have a limited amount of time, even not just in that session in the ER particularly, but others, where you have to make a decision. So you kind of make this preliminary diagnosis that you have, and then you order lab tests and imaging to confirm decision or maybe give you a different one. And we all know friends in medicine who have not succeeded, particularly in ER settings, where they simply can't let go of getting more data, right? I just need one more test, one more imaging study, right? One more diagnostic study. And to be a good doctor, you have to understand when there's enough data. And that's the same in executive decision making. You can't always have more consultants look at the information. You can't, sponsor another study of, you know, your marketing strategy. At some point, you have to make a decision. And that's a key component in terms of what doctors do, you know, many days of learning how to deal with limited data. And then the other aspect really is the symptom versus the cure. I mean, the symptom versus the cause, right? And we learn that a lot in medicine. And a good example is often you look at social media platforms and you'll say, well, we have low engagement, right? So we need to spend more money on paid, right? So we're going to do more paid advertising. So the issue there is the low engagement is a symptom, right? So you're trying to pay more money to get more people because you have low native engagement. You're going to need paid engagement. where that's the symptom. You have to look at the cause. And I've done this in different roles. But you see, the cause of the low engagement is because you're doing 7-minute videos, 8-minute videos, right? We just talked about it. It has to be 2 minutes. So it's really looking at the root cause. They were looking just at a symptom, right? I have low engagement and thinking that's how I'm going to treat the symptoms. And I'm saying you need to look at the cause. The cause is because your videos are too long and they may not be appropriate for who you're trying to reach in terms of the way they present the content. And that's one of the biggest discussions I focus on in the course. How do you diagnose? How do you create a symptom versus a cure? How do you make that distinction? And that's something the doctors deal with all the time.
I want to just build on your first point, because I think the biggest learning I've had from medicine applied to the real world is around exactly what you were saying, this Bayesian logic of thinking this is a tree or these are decisions to be had going further, and I will adjust the probabilities based on new information I get. But often I realized, especially in primary care, that when I didn't have a clue what was going on, it was very easy for me to just order more tests.
Yeah.
And it was very important to think, okay, in 4 weeks when this patient comes back with the test results, has that really changed anything that we're going to do? And if it's not going to impact that, then probably need to think twice about doing this test, because we're not really achieving anything here. And I think that is a big learning, and just that framework of thinking that a lot of times information gathering can be time wasting or procrastination when you really need to make a decision.
Absolutely. That's a good doctor approach. So it's that point. And I do the same as well. And when I work with residents and students, I always say, what are you going to do with that test? How's that going to change your decision making? Right. And sometimes they're just ordering it because that's what it seems they should do, or it's kind of this, you know, scattered approach. I'll just, you know, do a whole bunch of things and see what I get, you know, cast this wide net. That's not how most doctors think, and successful doctors think. It's a much more targeted approach. Now, with that, you also have to be willing to acknowledge that you could be wrong and change your decision based on the data. And there's always some doctors who are sticking with, it's the thyroid. I know it's the thyroid. I just need to, you know, look at, you know, the free thyroid now, thyroid binding, globulin. And they don't let it go, right? Because they have this bias in terms of their decision making. But I love that, you know, aspect. And that's how we think. We really have this Bayesian thinking that we're going to come up with this preliminary diagnosis and we're going to use data to confirm or, you know, change our opinion.
I guess another thing doctors, especially in high acuity areas, deal with well is risk, uncertainty, and stress. Have you taken any learnings for executives away from that in terms of how to deal with high risk, high stakes decisions, but then also to deal with high pressured, quick decisions as well? Like, what can people learn from that?
Yeah. And I will say, too often on the executive side, and probably on the doctor side too, everything isn't as high risk as we make it out to be. Part of that is because we've delayed decision making for a while and we haven't had a comprehensive strategy, because we're just ordering things that we really have no idea how to manage it. But it's also about time management. And it's also about, as I referenced early on, asking other people for advice, but asking them at the right time. Too often we ask people when it's, you know, last minute crises situation and we need help. That's never the time to be asking people to help. That's when you don't look as competent, because you should have planned for it beforehand. You should have prepared and had a strategy. Sometimes there are last minute decision makings by virtue of the exigencies of business that require a decision. But that goes to your point. You have to learn how to act with limited data. You also have to learn, despite that you think that everything is always, it's decided and you move on, sometimes it's a interim decision, right? And you might make a decision, but there's still some caveats that based on more information, you might change something. It's almost like in the drug approval process where you might have a decision in terms of accelerated approval where you make it sooner based on a surrogate outcome, but you want these phase four confirmatory studies that have to come later that may or may not change your decision. Sometimes we have to think about that. I mean, it's the broader issue of dealing with stress in our lives. That's a much broader discussion in our personal and business lives. But, you know, you're not always going to get it right, too, in terms of your decision-making. I've made lots of mistakes in my 20-plus years. But you learn from them, and then you move on. No one's perfect. And sometimes you're going to make those wrong decisions, and that's okay. You pick yourself back up, and you move forward.
John, let me ask you the reverse then. Mm-hmm. What things are there that executives should not learn from doctors or do a complete 180 on? Or another way of asking might be that when doctors enter the executive or, mm-hmm. or business or corporate world, what kind of things do they need to unlearn? What bad habits do we have?
There's still a lot of arrogance on many doctors that I'm the doctor, I know the best, this is my decision, this is how we go. And that's doesn't work in a business world. A lot of doctors, and there's some specialties, maybe not as much as internal medicine, they're still not as team players as they need to be in the business world. They all think they're the CEO, even though that might not be their title in the job, and that can be a challenge as well. So some doctors aren't always team players, and that's a problem in our environment. To be successful, you need to be a team player. And it kind of goes to your point. You need to know your area of expertise. So not all doctors have learned financial management, P&L management. I've had the opportunity to do that in my roles, and it's been a wonderful experience. But you also have to know what your skill set is and then be willing to take the time to learn new skills and additional skills, perhaps through additional coursework or other training. And sometimes doctors are a little reticent about it because we've done it for so long. Who wants to go back to class? Who wants to do another course? Or you'll figure it out on your own. That's not a good approach either.
I want to pick your brain a little bit on the future of health comms. So as a veteran of industry, having seen the shift we've had in, say, the past few decades, what do you see in the next 5 or 10 years? Very general question, but where are things going? Are we going to more extreme kind of high attention, highly provocative content? Are we going to rebound from that? Like, where do you see things going?
I think there's been fundamental change over the last 3 years, really during the pandemic. I think we've seen the growth of influencers that we had pre-pandemic, but not to the degree. My concern is the number of people with no health expertise. I'm not just saying medical expertise, but any health expertise giving advice in terms of how do you get healthy? How do you treat medical conditions? You know, that's my concern. I saw a patient a couple of months ago, came in, very bad burn of her left ear. And what she had done is she had microwaved hydrogen peroxide and put it in her ear and caused a very bad burn. And I asked her why she had done that. And she had said she had read a blogger about it that said you should microwave, make the hydrogen peroxide hot. This person had no medical expertise, but you know, she listened to it. And I've been talking lately about, it's interesting given the economic climate, I say to people, do you believe every financial gimmick that you read online? Would you just listen to any influencer on social media that told you how to invest your money? People express a lot of reticence to me. I mean, some still do, but others be like, no, that's like my savings. You know, I have to be careful. But then I say, but when it comes to your health, why are you willing to just listen to someone you don't know? You have no idea of their credentials, no idea of anything, yet they tell you, you know, to try this remedy and you're willing to try it. Or you're willing to forego. We see that in terms of cancer treatment, right? That people are trying some alternative therapies that sometimes cause harm. They also cause harm because of the opportunity cost. So I'm really concerned about the growth of influencers and how do we manage the amount of misinformation that's there when it comes to health. But something I'm really excited by is the democratizing of information. So we have so much more health information online by credible sources, WebMD, CDC. There's so many good sources out there. And really personalizing content to what people are looking for in terms of their health journey. And then connecting content to care. So in the past, you would search online about a health condition, and then you'd have to wait 6 weeks or longer to see your doctor, and you'd print it all out. Now, on many platforms, you search signs and symptoms of STD. We can connect you with a healthcare provider through a telehealth appointment, or we can arrange a lab right then that it can be sent to your home, or you could be sent somewhere to do. So you don't have to wait, right? So I'm empowering the consumer with more information, and I'm bringing that care straight to their home. And I'm putting them in charge of their healthcare data and their healthcare information. I think we still have a lot of progress to make there, but that's what's exciting. We're just from the waist up. I can't tell whether you're wearing a smart watch or what I'm calling smart jewelry. Are you wearing one?
No.
Okay. But we have so much data, right? From these wearables and trackers and sensors. And what are we doing with this data? That's your data that you're collecting over time. Health happens outside the doctor's office. And what I really care is what's happening to you on a daily basis. I have the data and the technology to do that. But how are we utilizing that? And that's where I'm putting you in charge of your information. And that's why it's so important about where you're getting your health information. You getting it from a healthcare professional? Or are you just asking your friend? In the old days, if I told you you had diabetes at the doctor's appointment, you'd listen, you'd nod your head, you'd go look online when you go home. Then what would you do? You'd call a friend, someone you know who has diabetes, or knows someone who has diabetes, right? And then you talk to them and hear that story, right? Back to that story. Now, what happens is it's not your friend or someone you know or anything about it, some random person that may or may not be real. Right? They may not even be real. Might be a bot. I don't know anything about them. And then why am I listening to them for my management of heart disease or diabetes or obesity? That's the real challenge. And by no means are all of them like that. There are many very good, credible influencers who do a great job of presenting health information. I'm concerned about the ones that don't.
Regarding the first point about the rise in health influencers, potentially some without any healthcare background giving erroneous advice. What are the kind of solutions you see to that problem? I mean, some might be around moderation from healthcare professionals. Mm-hmm. Another might be some kind of tiered system in which you have a kind of verified tick.
Yeah, I think that's been certified. Some of the biggest discussion, because it always becomes about First Amendment. What are people saying? But my concern about all of this is, and I live, as we referenced early on, in the DC area. Okay, if there's information about politics, I'm concerned about that. But if there's misinformation about health, that can impact your life in terms of how long you live and the quality of your life. So that's a big deal when we're talking about misinformation about health. So we really need to address it. I think there's lots of discussions about a verification program, which I think is a good idea in terms of there's some objective, transparent checklist that we use and have discussion around to give some type of verification of the information. And that's important. And I think people would be responsive to that, right? I think there has to be moderation to some degree to make sure that it's not harmful, right? Sometimes it can be wrong, but just not harmful. But other times it's wrong and harmful. And that's what we really need to be careful about. We've had some pluses and minuses of that in terms of moderation during the pandemic. I think we've had a lot of lessons learned from it. I think we need to continue to improve upon it. But if we don't do anything about it and be proactive, I think this is going to get worse over time, not better. So I do have a lot of concerns about it.
You've led a super interesting career and continue to do so with stints at the FDA, Discovery, WebMD, et cetera, et cetera. Have you always had a master plan? Have you just kind of just jumped at your curiosity between things? Is there any organizing principle or philosophy that you followed that's meant that you've been able to do a non-traditional and do a lot of fun stuff during your time?
You know, people always say to me, like, what's your five-year plan? Not as much. That's because I'm older. No, but I've never really had a five-year plan. I kind of gone to places. I tend to stay there like 7 years on average because I don't go to a job and then start looking for my other job. What I've done is I've been open to opportunities. So I don't necessarily solicit opportunities when I'm in a role, but I'm willing to be open to listen to them. And what's really interesting, I teased someone the other day. I'm like, I don't think I've actually really applied for a job in the past, you know, few years. And what I mean by that, and not to be pretentious, is the chief medical officer role at WebMD didn't exist prior to my arrival. They had a different type of role. My role at FDA is the director of professional affairs and stakeholder engagement. That office didn't exist prior to my arrival. So my point is, I always network with people because I like talking to people. And I worked with those hiring persons about the role that I wanted, that I would like to come to their organization to do. And that takes a lot of work. That takes some creativity. But that's why I've moved on from different roles, because I found a role that was going to be even more fulfilling and allow me to have an impact on people's lives. So that's kind of been my compass. And then be open to opportunities, but in some ways also to say, what's your dream job? And how would you find your dream job? And better yet, how would you create your dream job? So that's what I think is important when sometimes people get opportunities to talk about it, not just what it says on paper, but what it could be. And people often aren't willing to do that. And it takes more time to get that right, but it's well worth it in terms of finding that right role for you.
But similarly, opportunities don't just jump at you in a vacuum. So what have you done well in terms of networking, relationship building, maintaining those relationships? Are there any philosophies or practical things that you've done to enable those opportunities to fall at your door?
Sure. I'm very active on LinkedIn. I kind of referenced that, which I do think is a good site for thought leadership. I've been fortunate that I've had lots of speaking opportunities over my professional career. So I've met a lot of people through speaking. And I was also able to let my positions known and my competencies known by speaking. But the other thing I've done where I've networked a great deal is through writing. And, you know, when I was growing up, you still had to like submit something to your local paper. But I did. I was always writing editorials even when I was young. But now you have a lot of different platforms, Medium, you know, in the past was Huffington Post. There's so many of them that you can submit an article to. You can submit your own blog. So that's what I would encourage. Get your perspective out there, right? Get engagement in terms of what you're thinking. And that's going to bring opportunities to you. And it's going to bring the right opportunities to you, because you're going to put out there and transmit what your viewpoint is on something. Because obviously you want a good fit in terms of what you're going to do in your professional life and how that matches up with your goals and aspirations.
The last thing I wanted to ask was, have there been any habits or ways you approach problems or things that you do that you think have helped you get to where you are today?
You know, I'm much better nowadays in terms of just pausing when there's a problem. I think early on when we're younger, we kind of have this knee-jerk reaction that we're going to respond to everything and we're going to respond to it right now. So I've learned over the years, maybe don't send that email right now. Maybe don't send that call. Think about what might be going on in other people's lives, that maybe that's why their behavior is a certain way. So I've also become much more introspective, right? What do I want to accomplish? How might I manage this situation in a better way? Let me think about it a little longer, be a little more contemplative than be responsive immediately. Those are things I think I've have benefited from in terms of I've been guilty in the past of firing off some emails that maybe I would have rephrased differently the next day. And then being more empathic. Even when there's challenges at work with employees, sometimes it's what's going on in their personal lives that's making it difficult to do their job as best as they could. And we have to be cognizant of that and be responsive of that, and give our employees resources and tools to manage it. You know, I think there's challenges at times with the blurring of our work life and personal lives when we work from home. You know, we're working many more hours than we might have if we actually commuted to and from. So it's a lot of challenges right now for folks. And I think we have to be a little more empathic and empathetic, rather.
I hope you enjoyed that episode. You can find all my links by going to bigpicturemedicine.co.uk. And if you've been enjoying the podcast, then please consider leaving a review. And you can find links to John's course on LinkedIn in the description. Thanks for listening.